for the small purse hidden in my pocket and nudged Grandfather with my elbow. The farmer let his hand drop to the knife handle, rising up from his boot. The baby wailed, and the horse shifted nervously in his traces. The riders advanced. One of the men lifted his hat.
"Don't be afraid. We mean you no harm."
The farmer's hand stayed on the knife.
"You are entering Pembroke," said a second man. "Planning on staying here?"
"Just passing through," said the farmer. "I'm taking these folks on up to Gwynedd, and the wife and me are heading for her mother's in Bethlehem."
"We don't have any money," said the farmer's wife.
The first man took a piece of paper from under his coat.
"We aren't highwaymen, ma'am. We have been authorized by the town council to keep out fever victims. I have to ask you to step down so our doctor here can have a look at you. If you aren't sick, you can pass through town. If you are, you'll have to turn around."
The farmer jumped to the ground. His wife handed their baby down to him, then hopped into the dust herself. I shook Grandfather to wake him. The doctor examined the little family, peering under their eyelids and looking down their throats. I shook Grandfather harder.
"Wake up," I said. "There is a doctor who must see us."
He didn't move. Something twisted inside me. I pinched his nose.
"Grandfather,"
I said, my voice louder.
"Please wake up."
"Is there a problem here, miss?"
The doctor walked to the side of the wagon. He opened one of Grandfather's eyes with his fingers. Grandfather woke with a start.
"What in the name of heaven?"
Grandfather shouted. He broke off into a coughing fit.
"Water,"
he croaked. I looked at the men on horseback.
"Can he have some water, please? We have been traveling in the sun all morning."
The men looked at each other and at the doctor. Grandfather stopped coughing and leaned back wearily.
"I'm fine, child. I can wait until we get to the farm. I seem to have contracted a summer grip."
He turned to sit up straighter.
"No need for further delay. Off we go."
The doctor stepped back and covered his mouth with his hand.
"Take this man back to the city," he commanded. "He is infected with disease."
"No!"
the farmer shouted. One of the horsemen turned his horse and galloped away.
"Nonsense,"
Grandfather said.
"There's nothing wrong."
He broke off coughing again. I stared in horror, first at Grandfather, then at the doctor.
"You must help him," I cried. "If he is sick, you must help him."
The farmer grabbed me under the arms, pulled me from the wagon, and threw me onto the road. He and the doctor lifted Grandfather and deposited him beside me. King George squawked and circled above the commotion.
"They aren't my family,"
the farmer said as he motioned for his wife to climb aboard.
"They only rode in back the last mile or so. They was walking and we picked them up."
"He's lying," I shouted.
"I don't have no fever,"
the farmer continued.
"My wife and baby are healthy. Let me just drive through so I can get to Bethlehem by nightfall. We won't stop for nothing."
The doctor nodded to the leader of the group.
"Go ahead,"
the man said.
"Make haste."
The farmer brought the whip down with all his strength, and the wagon lurched forward. I stared, mouth open, as the wagon disappeared into a cloud of dust. Our food, our clothing, gone. This couldn't be happening.
"Go back to Philadelphia,"
the doctor advised.
"There are physicians there who will treat you. You can't stay here."
"We can't walk," I protested. "It's miles."
"Have you no mercy?"
asked Grandfather. The leader of the group looked down on him.
"We have to take care of our own, sir."
Grandfather glared at the man. I had never seen him so angry. He looked as if he wanted to run the man through with his sword. But he just stared.
"And I shall look after mine,"
Grandfather vowed.
"I shall look after mine."
Chapter 12. September 8th, 1793.
Our inhumane neighbors, instead of sympathizing with us, tauntingly proclaimed the healthfulness of their own cities. Letter of Ebenezer Hazard, Philadelphia, 1793. We hadn't walked far before Grandfather shook with chills.
"Let's rest a while under that chestnut tree, child,"
he suggested. I untied my apron and filled it with timothy grass until it formed a soft pillow for Grandfather's head. I wanted to ask him what we should do next, but he was asleep again before I could say a word. I bit the inside of my cheek to force back the tears. Crying wouldn't help anything. I put my hand on Grandfather's forehead. It was hot and dripping. "Think," I commanded myself. "We have no food or water. We're at least 10 miles out of the city. It would take hours to walk back, even if Grandfather felt well." "It is just a summer grip," I told myself. "It is just a summer grip. It had better be a summer grip, because there is no way to care for him if he is truly ill." I ran my tongue over my dry lips. The first thing we needed was a drink of water. I slipped Grandfather's canteen from his belt. His chest rose and fell steadily, and his heart thudded regularly. "I'll be back soon," I whispered as I kissed the damp white hair above his ear. I walked a few hundred paces south to where the road rose sharply. On top of the hill, I squinted along the horizon until I found what I was looking for. A line of willow trees. "Old soldier's trick," I said as I set off. "Find a willow tree, and you'll soon find water nearby." The stream was sweet and clear. I drank my fill and washed my face. It was much cooler under the willow than it had been under the chestnut tree. Maybe I could convince Grandfather to move here when he wakes, I thought. But first I had to find supper. A row of raspberry bushes, heavy with ripe fruit, lined the other side of the bank. I splashed over and started to pick the fruit. "Raspberry bushes mean rabbits are about," I told a curious bluebird watching from a milkweed plant. Grandfather could snare a rabbit, and I'd cook it over a small fire. With fresh water and food, we could stay under the willow until he regained his strength, then head back to the city. Grandfather would recuperate at home with Mother, and I could care for them both. I ate a handful of berries. My solution was perfect. "I have a plan!" I shouted as I ran back to the chestnut tree. I held my overskirt out in front of me to keep the raspberries from being crushed. The full canteen sloshed against my backside. Grandfather slowly opened his eyes. I peered closely. His eyes were bloodshot, but they were not yellow. "Good," I thought. "Just a summer grip." He pushed himself up to lean against the tree trunk.
"There's my cherub," he said.
"I knew you wouldn't leave me to face the enemy alone."
"Here," I fumbled with the canteen. "You need some water. You'll feel much better." Water spilled along his withered cheeks and down his neck. He wiped his mouth on his sleeve and smiled.
"Better than German wine."
"I have raspberries, too," I said.
"Sit close to me, child,"
he said.
"I want to see your face."
I made myself comfortable in the dirt and shared the berries with him. King George swooped down to help himself to dinner. I found a stream of fresh water, like a soldier would, by following the willows. It's beautiful and cool and peaceful. We'll go there after the sun sets. Once you recover your strength, we'll go home, and you can rest in your own bed. Grandfather slowly raised a raspberry to his mouth. A mockingbird in the meadow whistled, and King George took off in pursuit. Cicadas and crickets sang farewell to the sun, slipping toward the west.
"I'm a fool,"
Grandfather said. "Pardon me?"
"I'm a fool,"
he repeated.
"Worse, an old fool.
Lucille was right all along. I should have paid more attention. General Washington used to say my only fault was stubbornness. If not for that.
His voice drifted off, but his eyes did not close. Would he be strong enough to walk as far as the willows? Maybe we should try in the morning, after he had a good sleep. We sat in the cooling quiet as the stars crept out from the mantle of night.
I am concerned for your future,
he said.
We must form our battle plans, both for this skirmish and the rest of the war.
I waited for his advice. It did not come. That scared me more than anything. He was waiting for me to decide what to do. We'll move camp tomorrow, I finally said. He nodded.
Whatever you say, Captain.
Chapter 13. September 10th, 1793. American ladies require a peculiar mode of education. Dr. Benjamin Rush, speech to the Young Ladies' Academy of Philadelphia. The mockingbird whistled, and I woke with a start. I laid my hand on Grandfather's chest. His heart beat like a battle drum. My throat was parched, but the canteen was empty. I set off for the stream, King George fluttering behind me. I hoped Grandfather would sleep a while.
Pretty Maddie! Pretty Maddie!
The creature called. What do you want? I muttered. How could I get Grandfather to a doctor? If only I could send word to Eliza, she could arrange for a carriage. A carriage with a doctor and food and a clean shift. A breeze rattled through a cornfield, lifting the leaves like outstretched arms. King George landed on my shoulder.
Tea, Maddie! I need tea!
I brushed him off. Hush, you foolish creature, or I'll make a pillow out of you. Mother thought I was safe at Gwynedd, slopping the pigs and hoeing the fields. Would she worry when Grandfather didn't return? I kicked a rock down the road. Why couldn't I have acted strong and calm like Eliza, instead of blubbering like a baby? I disgusted Mother. She knew I was weak. I bet she wanted sons. Instead, she got a backward, lazy girl child. I kicked the rock deep into the brambles. I shook my head to rid it of the dark thoughts. I would only consider the good. Mother was surely getting stronger with every hour. Grandfather and I would find a carriage or wagon that would give us a ride to the Luddingtons. When we arrived, we would find a letter from Mother, telling us that all was well and we could go home. I took a deep breath. It felt better to think about pleasant things.
Maddie, child! Maddie, child! Buy me rum!
King George landed on a wild rose bush. Go on with you, flea bag. Find us a pot of porridge or an apple pie. I worked my way around a patch of thistles. The sun burned off the haze, and the dew vanished. My stomach rumbled. If only that blasted farmer had left our food hamper. Along with cinnamon buns, Eliza had packed hot cakes and ham, a crock of cherry preserves, another of garlic pickles, and a hard ball of cheese carefully wrapped. I reached the stream hungry, hot, and tired. With no prying eyes around, I slipped off one of my petticoats, washed it in the water, and hung it over a willow branch to dry. I waded in up to my knees and stood until my toes felt as if they were in a snowbank. What would Nathaniel think if he saw me like this? Would he think me a finer catch than any trout? When the cold became unbearable, I climbed out of the water to pick berries. It was hard not to think of our kitchen table with bowls of oyster stew or corn soup, a platter of duck, sweet potatoes and buttered beans. Indian pudding with molasses, or better yet, apple brown Betty with extra sugar on top. The sound of fish leaping from the water interrupted my fantasies. I turned in time to see scales reflecting the sunlight as the fish slid downstream. Fish! But how to catch one with neither line nor hooks? Where was Nathaniel Benson and his fishing pole when I needed him? My wet petticoat swayed in the breeze. It would have to do. I tried to rip open the seam with my teeth, but the tiny stitches that Mother had sewed would not yield. Another fish wiggled to the top of the water to gulp down a water bug. If I had sewn the skirt, it would have been easy to tear apart. Instead, I would have to use it whole. I pulled the drawstring at the waist tightly until I could barely poke my thumb through the opening. I would hold open the hem and pray an unusually stupid fish would swim into the trap. "I bet no soldier ever thought of this one," I said, wading back in the water with my improvised net. My feet iced right away, and it was hard to find a comfortable position. I had to bend over at the waist, wave the petticoat in the water to make it float, then stand without moving. I wiggled my toes to bring some feeling back in them. How could my feet be so cold while my head was so hot? A bee buzzed in front of my face. In the distance, I heard a carriage escaping from Philadelphia. Food first, rescue second. I blew the bee away. Where was that stupid parrot? He could be useful and feast on this pest. A fish brushed against my ankle. "Come, little fishy, come down," I murmured. My arm shook from the effort of holding the petticoat open. The fish paused at the edge of the net. "Just a few more inches. That's it. Keep swimming." The bee landed on my mob cap just above my eyebrows. I concentrated on the fish. "You're almost there, my little fried breakfast. Don't stop now." I prepared to close the petticoat and trap the fish inside. "One, two..."
"Tea, Maddie!"
King George swooped straight at my head and snatched the bee. The explosion of feathers in my face sent me crashing into the water. I came up sputtering and saw the trout flick his tail and head downstream, where there were no girls with petticoats and no parrots.
"I'll roast you!"
I shouted at the king, shaking my dripping petticoat in his direction.
"Fresh thing!"
he replied. There was no time to try for another fish. Grandfather was alone and without water. I filled the canteen, scoured the bushes for the last berries, and hurried back. Grandfather's eyes were still clear, but his nose was red and his throat raspy.
"Cold," he said.
"Cold? Are you cold?" How could he be cold? The sun had nearly dried my wet skirts. He shivered. "Shall I make a fire?" He closed his eyes and nodded. Even the effort of speaking a few sentences had exhausted him. At home, I would borrow a burning twist of paper from a neighbor when all the fires in the house were cold. I couldn't remember the last time I saw a fire started with flint and tinder. I didn't even have flint and tinder. Grandfather shivered and moaned. I washed his face and neck with the damp petticoat that didn't catch fish. It seemed to comfort him.
"Is there anything to eat?"
I coughed and shook my head. "All we have are these berries, Grandfather."
"Of course. I forgot."
He ate a few.
"We need food."
I thought about telling him how close I had been to capturing that trout, but I hated to admit defeat. Grandfather struggled to remove a pouch from his vest.
"There must be a farm hereabout. Pay for a meal and the loan of a few blankets."
"I can't leave you. You look worse." He held up his hand.
"I'll be fine.
I'll sit here and watch the wind blow. Think about old friends. We need food and blankets. Off with you.
The sun was at its highest as I set out on my search. It felt like a bonfire spitting embers on my head. I took the first narrow road that branched off toward the east, sure that it would lead to a farm. The man hoeing a field of potatoes took one look at me and ran off. I followed him to a farmhouse, but the door was locked.
"Go away!" shouted a voice inside. "We have children in here! We can't help you if you have the fever!"
What was wrong with the world? Would I next see birds flying backward or cows crocheting doilies? I walked on, stopping now and then to cough or rest my legs. The heat rolled to the horizon like waves toward shore. Except for a few raspberries, I had eaten nothing for 2 days. A flock of geese flew overhead. I could only think of how they would taste with roast potatoes. Grandfather would need more water soon. I needed to go back. I stumbled along, head down, fighting to keep my eyes from closing. My shoe squashed something brown and green and soft. I shuddered and hurried my pace. I could never abide rotted fruit. It drew flies. Fruit. Fruit? I spun around, wide awake and hungry. Above me hung gnarled branches heavy with green speckled pears. I grabbed one and bit into it, ignoring the juice that ran down my fingers and chin. I gathered as many pears as I could carry and set off with new energy to find Grandfather. With food, we could hold out for days. I didn't notice when the pears grew heavy. By the time the chestnut tree was in sight, they felt like tiny anvils weighing me down. I breathed heavily and focused on moving 1 foot at a time. I turned around. Did I hear voices whispering? A swarm of gnats flew into my eyes. I stumbled and dropped a few pears. I looked up. The chestnut tree seemed farther away. I felt like I was sliding backwards. I wasn't walking on a dirt road. I was slipping across the frozen river. The sun wasn't made of fire. It was a monstrous snowball. My teeth clattered together. What was wrong with me? I saw a figure stand under the tree. I tried to call Grandfather's name, but could make no sound. The wind carried a roaring sound. Why was I carrying these rocks? I stumbled. Where was Mother? Where was Eliza? The balloon. I'll be up in a minute, Mother. Just let me sleep. Then, blackness. Chapter 14. September 12th through 20th, 1793. Hot, dry winds forever blowing. Dead men to the graveyards going. Constant hearses, funeral verses. Oh, what plagues, there is no knowing. Philip Freneau. Pestilence. Written during the prevalence of a yellow fever. 1793.
Is she dead?
Go away, Barney. She's not ready for you.
I've got to take the bodies to the pit before I'll get my soup. If she's dead, hand her over. I'm hungry.
I opened my eyes to see who was talking. A large woman holding a candle bent over me, and a man waited in the shadows. The light from the candle burned my eyes. I heard moans on both sides of me, and the sound of hammers and saws in the distance. Where am I? I thought. I was so cold, colder than New Year's Day. I closed my eyes.
She looks dead,
Barney said. His voice faded away. I slept, and the fever fired my dreams with terror. I was back by the chestnut tree. Dust billowed. As I breathed, dirt caked my throat and settled in my lungs. The road was crowded with carriages pulled by wild-eyed horses that crashed into each other as everyone fought to escape.
"What am I supposed to do?" I cried to people rushing by. "I don't know what to do!"
I ran across the meadow and came upon a troop of soldiers marching, with a drummer boy and flag-bearer in front.
"Look at me!" I called, holding Grandfather's watch. "Tell me what to do!"
"Arrêtez-vous!"
shouted a soldier.
"Arrêtez-vous!"
"I don't understand you," I said. "I don't speak French."
I walked toward the men. Grandfather appeared by the flag-bearer. He wore a bloody shirt. He did not recognize me, and he shouted to his troops.
"Ready!"
Grandfather drew his sword from the scabbard and held it in the sky. He looked at me and narrowed his angry eyes.
"Aim!"
The men aimed their muskets at me. Grandfather slashed the sword through the air.
"Fire!"
"No!"
I jolted awake. Moonlight spilled in through the open windows. I rubbed my eyes, trying to sort out where the nightmare stopped and the waking world began. My sheets and shift were soaked through with sweat, blood, and the foul-smelling black substance that marked a victim of yellow fever. Yellow fever. There were beds on either side of me. To my left slept a young woman, her hair in two dirty braids. To my right lay a figure covered with a sheet. A corpse. Who was dead and who was alive? Was it Grandfather? Was it Mother? I reached for the sheet, but stopped. My head spun as if it were on a rope swing, twisting dizzily. I closed my eyes until the sensation faded. Taking a deep breath, I lifted the sheet at the side of the body. The hand was thin and the fingers slender, with tapered nails and fine bones. It was not the fleshy, scarred hand of Grandfather, nor the work-worn hand of my mother. My eyes filled with tears. Two orderlies walked to the bed of the corpse. They spoke quietly in French. Each man took one end of the dead woman's mattress and lifted, then carried the body away. Just as I slipped back toward sleep, the men brought back the mattress. Empty. When I woke, the tall windows were shuttered to keep out the sunlight. Steam fairly rose from the reeking bodies of the sick, and sweat dripped off the faces of the nurses and orderlies. The room reminded me of the Ogilvy mansion, only larger. The flowing draperies, expensive carpets, and hand-carved furniture that surely belonged here had been removed. What remained were enormous rooms with high ceilings and a chandelier that reflected the light like a thousand mirrors.
"Oh my, now that's looking much better, isn't it? You've beat the Grim Reaper, you have, lassie."
A large woman strode to my bedside. She set a tray on the floor.
"I'm Mrs. Flagg, and I'm here to care for you," she said. "We weren't sure you would make it through the night, but that's past now. It's time for you to eat something so we can get you home to your loved ones."
Mrs. Flagg helped me sit up.
"Your granddad has been waiting this whole time for you. Quite a handsome man, isn't he? A captain in the army, he told me. I'll sneak him in here soon as I get the chance. Now drink this."
She held a bowl of beef broth to my lips. I pushed the bowl away.
"How is he? How did we get here?"
She set the bowl on her lap.
"He doesn't have yellow fever, if that's what you're asking. Told me his heart was acting up in the heat, and he had a bit of a cough, perhaps. But he's such a strong man. Imagine a man his age carrying someone like you all that distance."
I relaxed. If Grandfather was feeling well enough to tell exaggerated stories and charm Mrs. Flagg, Then there was little to worry about. I reached for the bowl. The salty broth warmed my insides. "Thank you," I said. "That was delicious." Mrs. Flagg set the bowl on the floor. She wrung out a rag that had been soaking in soapy water and wiped my face and hands before lifting my dirty hair to wash my neck.
"My mother always said a good wash was the best medicine. If you keep the broth down, we'll let you eat a bit of rice for dinner. Now you rest a spell. I'll be back soon. Then the doctor will have a look at you when he makes his rounds. Oh, my gracious! Look who's coming, and me wearing this filthy dress."
Grandfather, he never looked so handsome or brave as standing in the middle of the sick room, his eyes searching all the beds until he found me. I felt like I was 6 years old again, and Grandfather was marching in a parade. He bowed to Mrs. Flagg and sat on the edge of my bed.
"What are you doing in bed, girl? You look healthy enough to jump up and give poor Mrs. Flagg here a hand,"
Grandfather said as he kissed my cheek. Mrs. Flagg wagged her finger at him.
"Don't you be giving her any ideas, Captain. What this young thing needs is rest and nourishing food, and she'll get both of them here, or my name isn't Bridget Flagg."
"Bridget!"
exclaimed Grandfather.
"A melodious name for a beautiful lady."
I rolled my eyes while Mrs. Flagg giggled. "Excuse me," I said, interrupting the two of them. "Where are we? And how long have we been here?" Mrs. Flagg was all business.
"No one has told you. Poor little chickie. You're at Bush Hill, and a good thing it is you are."
"Bush Hill! We must leave," I said as I pulled the blanket off my legs. "We must go. This is a dangerous place, Grandfather. Take me home." I tried to stand, but my legs gave way.
"Now, now, Maddie,"
Grandfather stammered. Mrs. Flagg took me by the shoulders and sat me back down. Before I knew it, I was lying down with a sheet tucked so tightly over me that I couldn't move.
"That will be enough standing up, young miss," said Mrs. Flagg firmly. "You've nothing to fear. Bush Hill is now a respectable place. Your grandfather was a clever, kind man to bring you here."
The city had turned a mansion on Bush Hill into a hospital for fever victims. According to the gossips, Bush Hill was one step away from hell, filled with dead bodies and criminals who preyed on the weak. It was a place to stay away from, not a place where a young girl should lay about and sip broth, even if her grandfather was mooning over her nurse. Mrs. Flagg lifted a mug of cool tea to my mouth.
"You listen to me. This here Bush Hill is not the same Bush Hill of last week. Mr. Stephen Gerard, Lord bless his name, has taken over and turned this into a right proper hospital. All of them thieving scoundrels have been driven off. You're lucky you were brought here. We have doctors, nurses, medicine, food, everything a fever victim needs. And we have enough problems without you running off the ward."
Grandfather coughed, and I handed him my tea. He emptied the cup and handed it back to me.
"Maddie knows all about Stephen Gerard,"
he told Mrs. Flagg.
"He has visited our fine establishment several times. Indeed, it has been my honor to break bread with him."
Break bread? Since when did he call stuffing down Eliza's cinnamon rolls in the same room as Stephen Gerard and 20 others breaking bread? Grandfather did admire Mr. Gerard. That much was true. Gerard was a rich Frenchman with a finger in every pie. He was a merchant, an importer, and a banker. But what did Mr. Gerard have to do with Bush Hill?
"He came through here like a hurricane, he did," Mrs. Flagg explained. "He fired the slovenly devils who caused all the trouble. Then he ordered repairs on the water pumps, hired good folks like me, and laid in supplies. We even have a fancy French officer, Dr. Devese, who supervises the patients, and Mrs. Saville for our matron.
With a name like Bridget, you are surely not French, are you, Mrs. Flagg?
Asked Grandfather.
Good gracious, no, what a question,
laughed Mrs. Flagg.
I can barely make out what they're saying half the time, but they work hard, and the pay is good.
And I'll tell you this, she said,
leaning closer and lowering her voice.
You'll hear folks say that Dr. Rush is a hero for saving folks with his purges and bloodletting. But I've seen different. It's these French doctors here that know how to cure the fever. I don't care if Dr. Rush did sign the Declaration of Independence. I wouldn't let him and his knives near me.
I shivered as I remembered the blood Dr. Kerr had drained from Mother. Maybe Grandfather should return to the house and bring her here. What if Dr. Kerr bled her too much? Does Mother know I'm here? I asked. Grandfather sat down on my bed.
It's quite a topsy-turvy time we're in, my sweet. We've been gone from home nearly 5 days now.
What? 5 days?
Mrs. Flagg gently pushed me back on the pillow.
Easy, child.
Much has happened,
Grandfather continued.
Once you were installed here, I rode into the city to see Lucille, tell her where you were.
He paused to cough.
I found the house locked up tight as you like. Knowing her, she rode out to Ludington's to join us. I sent a letter yesterday.
Mrs. Flagg picked up the tray.
There you go. Everything is right with the world. You might not hear back from your mother for a while, though. The post has become most unreliable.
She said something else, but I could only hear buzzing. My eyes closed against my will.
Now look what we've done, Captain, Mrs. Flagg exclaimed. Here we are, chatting like magpies, and your darling granddaughter still so sick.
Grandfather patted my head.
Sleep well, child.
Chapter 15. September 22nd, 1793. Wives were deserted by husbands and children by parents. The chambers of disease were deserted, and the sick left to die of negligence. None could be found to remove the lifeless bodies. Their remains, suffered to decay by piecemeal, filled the air with deadly exhalations, and added tenfold to the devastation. Charles Brockden Brown, Arthur Mervyn, or Memoirs of the Year 1793. For long days and nights, stories flew over my head as I slept in my narrow bed at Bush Hill. Nurses and doctors, weeping relatives, and volunteers from the Free African Society whispered their sorrows. They echoed around the beautiful hall with the glittering chandelier. They told of a small child found huddled around the body of her dead mother. As volunteers placed the mother in a coffin, the child had cried out, "Why are you putting Mama in that box?" They had to turn the child over to a neighbor and take the mother away for burial. They told of the dying man who pulled himself to the window of his bedchamber and begged people to bring him a drink of water. Many passed by, hurrying away from the sound of his voice, until a brave soul entered the house to help him. They told of thieves who crept in and stole jewelry off the dead and dying. They told of good people who refused to take any money for helping strangers, even though they themselves were poor and near destitute. They told of the mighty who had fallen ill, Secretary of the Treasury Alexander Hamilton, and Dr. Rush himself. Both had recovered, though Dr. Rush's sister had died. Hamilton had fled the city. They told of terror, patients who had tried to jump out of windows when the fever robbed their reason, screams that pierced the night, people who were buried alive, parents praying to die after burying all their children. I laid my pillow over my head to protect myself from visions of the dead, but I could not breathe. No one told stories of a painter's assistant named Nathaniel, or a cook named Eliza. No one told of my mother. A breeze stirred through the open window, and the crystals of the chandelier struck a gentle chord. The voices faded. On the 10th morning, I was visited by a French doctor, Dr. Devese. He did not carry a lancet or bowl. He seemed most concerned with the color of my eyes and tongue, and the temper of my pulse. He grunted with satisfaction.
"She will live,"
Dr. Devese said. He turned to Mrs. Flagg.
"She stays here one more night, then move her to the barn. You have the hunger?"
he asked me. "Yes," I answered. "I'm famished."
"Feed this girl," he said with a smile. "It is good to see a patient who eats."
He patted my hand and moved on. Excuse me, please," I called after him. What would happen to me? Did we have to walk to Gwynedd? How could we get home? My voice was too weak to carry far, and the doctor was already concentrating on the next jaundiced face.
"What's the trouble, love?"
asked Mrs. Flagg as she brought a dinner tray. As I poured out my concerns to her, she tucked a napkin under my chin.
"Too many questions. You'll make yourself sick again. There is only one thing for you to worry about, finishing this here meal. You won't be leaving here for a few days at least. You can't solve tomorrow's problems today, but you can put some meat on those skinny bones."
I nodded and dug into my supper. It didn't take long to finish the small portion of mutton and bread. When it was gone, Mrs. Flagg handed me a bowl of rice and boiled prunes. "It's got a wee bit of sugar on it," she whispered. "Young ladies need something sweet. And when you're done with that, you'll have a good wash and move to your new bed over in the barn." The barn wasn't at all what I imagined. The faint smell of manure was everywhere, but the walls were whitewashed and the dirt floor swept clean. The oak doors stood open to let in sunshine and whatever breeze there was. Thick stone walls kept the inside as cool as a cellar. I preferred the smell of hay and horses to the death stench of the hospital. It was a relief to be around people who had the strength to sit up and didn't cry out in pain. Grandfather looked in on me several times a day. I think he was uncomfortable being around the sick. Mrs. Flagg filled me in on his activities. He helped to organize the delivery of food and the burning of filthy mattresses and rags. He sat in on the committee meetings where decisions were made about raising money and caring for the sick. He had pitched a tent in the yard and told me stories about watching the stars at night. I think he secretly enjoyed the commotion. It reminded him of the war again. It gave him something to do. I would gladly have joined him, but I was too tired. I spent several days eating mutton that tasted like sawdust, picking bugs off my blanket, and sleeping. I did not have any more nightmares, but I always woke confused, thinking I was surrounded by people I knew instead of sick strangers. Once I thought I saw Nathaniel, but it was another nameless orderly. I wondered if I were being haunted by ghosts. How had Nathaniel fared? Was he lying in a sick bed, thinking of me? Doubtful. He was probably painting flowers for one of Master Peel's daughters, who watched him with stupid cow eyes. I couldn't remember where I had put his painting before we left home. Had I shown it to Mother? What if she found it? Would she burn it? Thinking of Mother made me twist and turn restlessly. She had not responded to the letters Grandfather sent to the Luddingtons. I could see her ordering the Luddington pigs to march in a straight line, or replanting their cornfields in orderly rows. If I had recovered from the fever, surely she was on her feet again. Unless... I couldn't think of that possibility. But why hadn't she written? Maybe she was glad to be rid of me for a while. Eliza would miss me, but I had no idea how to find her. Some thought that black-skinned people couldn't get yellow fever, but I had seen two sick in the hospital. Eliza lived close to the river, where the disease had started. Who would take care of her if she were sick? Every day I felt stronger and had more questions. By the sixth morning, I felt ready to explode with frustration. I left my bed for the first time and walked to the necessary without assistance. This was a sweet victory. After lunch, I was visited by Mrs. Flagg and a frowning clerk with a spotted face who carried an account book, an inkpot, and quill.
"We have not been able to contact your mother, miss," said the man as he squinted to read the writing on the page.
"Cook.
Miss Cook," he scribbled on the page. "You are well enough to leave. It would be immoral to turn a child out into the streets, so you will be taken to the orphan house."
"No, I am not an orphan." He raised an eyebrow.
"Where is your father?"
"He died years ago."
"Your mother was ill, according to Mrs. Flagg, but you do not know her whereabouts."
"She was sick, but I'm sure she's better now. She's at home, the Cook Coffee House. If you will just send me there."
"Other relatives?"
Mrs. Flagg interrupted.
"Mattie is the granddaughter of Captain William, the gentleman who has been such a help in the kitchen. I'll fetch him now. He has been waiting for the doctor to release her."
The clerk did not look pleased that I had a living relative. His heart was set on sending me to the orphan house, I could tell. His pen scratched along the page. He blew on it to dry the ink, then closed the book and folded his glasses. He opened his mouth once to say something, but closed it again. He looked like a toad. Mrs. Flagg returned with Grandfather in tow. His face was bright red and his shirt was stained, but I thought he looked as handsome as ever.
"What's this I hear about you being ready to go back into battle?"
Grandfather asked. The toady clerk answered for me.
"Patients who have recovered enough to walk on their own must be discharged, sir. Provisions can be made to send this child to the orphan house, if you prefer."
I squeaked a protest.
"I am not a child."
"She can stay in the orphan house until her mother is found. If she is found,"
the clerk amended.
"She would be cared for quite well, sir. I can assure you of that. Life will be difficult for us all until these dark times are over. The orphan house may be the safest place for her."
Grandfather puffed up his chest and crossed his arms.
"No kin of mine goes to an orphan house, not as long as I have breath in my body. Your recommendation is insulting, sir. I served with President Washington himself. I commanded troops that sent redcoats running back across the ocean. And you suggest that I cannot care for this little snippet of a girl? I shall report your impudence to the President."
The man pinched the top of his nose and wrinkled his brow.
"If President Washington is displeased, you may encourage him to come here and speak to me directly,"
the clerk said.
"We have too many lost souls wandering the city streets. I wouldn't want to see this girl join them. But you need not listen to me. My work is done. There is a wagon going into the city tomorrow. You may ride along."
He gave Grandfather the smallest of nods, gathered his supplies, and hopped off.
"Foolish, meddling nitwit,"
grumbled Grandfather. He would have said more, but just then he broke into a fit of coughing. He pulled at his collar and gasped for air. Mrs. Flagg pushed him down to sit on my bed, and I pounded his back in alarm. When the fit passed, he sat motionless for a moment, then opened his eyes.
"Look at the two of you,"
he laughed.
"What,
Did you expect me to expire right here? No such luck. I've got a girl to care for. And,
he lifted Mrs. Flagg's hand to his lips,
a lady whom I've promised to take to a ball one day.
Mrs. Flagg dissolved into giggles that reminded me of the Ogilvy sisters. Chapter 16. September 24th, 1793. He who sitteth upon the pale horse, he whose name is Death, will be sent through the streets of Philadelphia. Quaker Prophecy, Philadelphia, 1793. Mrs. Flagg blew her nose into her kerchief with a loud honk.
"So much grief packed into one wagon,"
she said tearfully.
"Fear not, brave Mrs. Flagg,"
said Grandfather. He saluted her.
"Our deepest thanks for your care and shelter. Please accept my most sincere hopes that we may meet again under healthier circumstances."
Mrs. Flagg curtsied deeply.
"May the Lord keep and preserve all of you."
She waved goodbye, and the wagon rolled forward. Soon Bush Hill faded into the horizon. Grandfather and I were riding along with 5 fever orphans who were being sent to the orphan house. Grandfather rode at the front with the driver, a relatively clean man with neatly combed hair and a smooth face. He quietly whistled a tune, one of Grandfather's favorites. They would be good company for the journey. I sat on the hardest plank in the back, next to a woman named Mrs. Bowles. 2 boys huddled together for comfort. They looked like brothers. The other children stared vacantly ahead. One girl looked to be my age. Her neck was dirty, and her dress was torn. I wanted to speak to her, but couldn't think of what to say. When she saw me looking at her, she turned away. Mrs. Bowles was a straight-backed woman dressed in Quaker gray. She was older than Mother, with kind eyes and laughter lines that curled around the sides of her mouth. As we drove away from the hospital, she picked up the smallest crying child and sat him in her lap. The child's sobs kept time with the rhythm of horse hooves on the road. He wiped his nose on the front of her dress and snuggled closer in her arms.
"Mrs. Flagg explained that you have been through a great deal,"
Mrs. Bowles said gently. "Yes, ma'am."
"These are trying times. They seem to bring out the best and worst in the people around us."
We sat in silence, watching as the slate roofs of the houses on the outskirts of the city came into view. Mosquitoes, gnats, and flies followed the wagon, drawn by the smell of the sweating children and horses.
"How old are you, Matilda?"
14. 15 in December.
"And are you feeling recovered from your illness? Fully recovered?"
I nodded. "My only complaint is that my stomach grumbles all the time." She smiled and shifted the child in her arms.
"That is normal enough for someone your age. If I may inquire,"
she began delicately.
"Yes?" "Have you considered what you might do to help? You have recovered, so you cannot get the fever again. You are young and strong. We have a real need for you."
"How can I help anyone? I'm just a girl." As soon as the words were out of my mouth, I wanted to pinch myself. The first time anyone treats me like a woman, and I respond like an infant.
"You are much more than a girl, let me assure you of that. You are older than Susanna there."
She inclined her head toward the girl with the dirty neck.
"She has lost her family, but we are not taking her in as an orphan. She will help us with the younger children."
The child in Mrs. Bowles' lap stirred and whimpered.
"Shh, hush," she whispered to the little one. "I know that you have not received any word from your mother yet. It may be better for you to stay with us.
We would keep you fed and warm, and you could provide us with a much-needed extra pair of hands. The wagon had reached the part of the city where new houses and businesses were under construction, where there should have been an army of carpenters, masons, glaziers, plasterers, and painters. I saw only empty shells of buildings, already falling into disrepair after a few weeks of neglect. "Grandfather would not allow it," I said with confidence. "If Mother is still out in the country, then we too shall care for each other. He doesn't know the first thing about shopping at the market or cooking, and I need him to chop wood, and he will make sure I am well." "It is good you have each other," said Mrs. Bowles in the same placid voice. "But you should not leave your house once you arrive. The streets of Philadelphia are more dangerous than your darkest nightmare. Fever victims lay in the gutters. Thieves and wild men lurk on every corner. The markets have little food. You can't wander. If you are determined to return home with your grandfather, then you must stay there until the fever abates." Grandfather turned to address us.
"We may end up at the Ludingtons' farm after all," he said. "Josiah here tells me there's not much food to be found anywhere, Mattie. I'll write to them again as soon as we arrive home."
"Won't do you no good," the driver interrupted. "The post office just closed down. It could take until Christmas before they can deliver letters."
Mrs. Bowles patted my arm. "Don't fret, Matilda. If you like, you may choose to take employment at the orphanage. I'm sure the trustees would approve a small wage if you helped with the cleaning or minding the children. They have for Susanna. She'll help with the laundry." Susanna didn't look strong enough to wash a teaspoon, much less a tub full of clothing. "What will happen to her when the fever is over?" I whispered. Mrs. Bowles lowered her voice.
"She is at a difficult age. She's too old to be treated as a child, but not old enough to be released on her own. Her parents owned a small house. The trustees will sell that and use the money for her dowry. We will hire her out to work as a servant or scullery maid. She's attractive enough. I'm sure she'll find a husband."
A fly bit the ear of the child on Mrs. Bowles's lap, and his howl cut off the conversation. Scullery maid. That was one thing I would never be. I imagined Mother's face when she arrived home and found what a splendid job I had done running the coffee house. I could just picture it. I would be seeing the last customers out the door when Mother would come up the steps. She would exclaim how clean and well-run the coffee house was. Grandfather would point out the fancy dry goods store I was building next door. I would blush, looking quite attractive in my new dress. French, of course. Perhaps I could hire Susanna to do the washing up. That would be a way of helping. I broke off my daydream to take in our surroundings. Grandfather and the driver had stopped swapping stories. He turned to look back at me anxiously. We were in the center of a dying city. It was night in the middle of the day. Heat from the brick houses filled the streets like a bake oven. Clouds shielded the sun. Colors were overshot with gray. No one was about. Businesses were closed and houses shuttered. I could hear a woman weeping. Some houses were barred against intruders. Yellow rags fluttered from railings and door knockers. Pus yellow. Fear yellow. To mark the homes of the sick and the dying. I caught sight of a few men walking, but they fled down alleys at the sound of the wagon. "What's that?" I asked, pointing to something on the marble steps of a three-story house.
"Don't look, Matilda," said Grandfather. "Turn your head and say a prayer."
I looked. It appeared to be a bundle of bed linens that had been cast out of an upper window. But then I saw a leg and an arm.
"It's a man," Stop the wagon! We must help him!
He is past helping, miss,
the driver said as he urged on the horses.
I checked him on the way out to fetch you this morning. He were too far gone to go to the hospital. His family tossed him out.